Chapter 3. The Parent's Dilemma. Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, 1689 to 1762, was a notably brilliant member of British aristocratic society during the reigns of George I and George II. In 1716, her husband, Edward Wortley Montagu, was appointed ambassador at Constantinople to negotiate an end to Austro-Turkish War. During her 2 years in the capital, she wrote her Turkish Embassy Letters about her adventures in the Ottoman Empire. Written in a vivid and often humorous style, her letters are full of interesting observations about life, family, womanhood, marriage, and medicine. Like Dr. Emmanuel Timonius, who was in Constantinople at the same time, Lady Mary became a true believer in the smallpox inoculation procedure that was practiced in the Ottoman court. As she saw it, not only could it save your life, it could also protect a woman's beauty from scarring. A striking beauty in her youth, her lovely skin was marred by smallpox she contracted in 1715 at the age of 26. In 1716, some of her town eclogues, satirical poems about the court of George I, were published without her permission. One of the poems made fun of the Princess of Wales, Caroline of Ansbach, whose skin had also been marred by smallpox she had contracted in 1707. Lady Mary had her own children inoculated and advocated the procedure in letters to her aristocratic friends in England. In 1722, Princess Caroline interviewed Lady Mary's children about their experience with inoculation. She then persuaded her father-in-law, George I, to commute the sentences of 6 prisoners at Newgate Prison if they agreed to participate in an inoculation experiment. She also proposed inoculating foundlings, abandoned infants, which were common in London at the time. After consulting with the Royal Society and conducting her own research, Princess Caroline had her own children inoculated. Her decision was widely reported in the press, and it convinced many parents that the procedure was safe. Back in the North American colonies, Benjamin Franklin became a prominent advocate of variolation in the 1730s, a reversal from a decade earlier when he edited Dr. Douglas's essays against inoculation in the New England Courant. His change of heart was apparently precipitated by the death of his second son, Francis Folger Franklin. As described in the 2011 New York Times essay, Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Vaccines, by Howard Markle, M.D., Frankie, as his parents called him, was born in 1732, a golden child, his smiles brighter, his babblings more telling, and his tricks more magical than all the other infants in the colonies combined. Benjamin advertised for a tutor when the boy was only 2. When he died of smallpox at age 4, the Franklins were beyond condolence. His tombstone was inscribed, "The delight of all who knew him." Rumors abounded that Frankie had died from an inoculation gone awry. The gossip led the grieving Franklin to declare that his son had never been inoculated because he was suffering from flux or protracted diarrhea. Franklin insisted that Frankie received the distemper, smallpox, in the common way of infection. Following this terrible experience, Franklin became a tireless advocate of smallpox inoculation in the colonies, and it's easy to understand why. How many nights did he and his wife lie awake wondering whether Frankie would still be with them if only they had gotten him inoculated? As imperfect as it was, inoculation seemed to offer at least some hope, as we have all experienced when faced with a fearful prospect. Doing something to try to improve our odds often strikes us as better than nothing. For many reasonable people, gambling on the inoculation, therefore, seemed like a risk worth taking. At the same time, Franklin understood that the doctors of his day had a powerful financial incentive to proclaim the safety and efficacy of inoculation. Today's celebratory literature about smallpox inoculation in the 18th century rarely mentions that doctors charged a fortune for the procedure, more than many colonists' annual income. That such handsome fees could be charged may account for why Dr. William Douglas, the foremost opponent of inoculation in 1721 to 1722, became an inoculator in the 1730s. In 1774, Benjamin Franklin established the Society for Inoculating the Poor gratis, but this was only after 50 years of inoculation among the upper class. That only the rich could afford inoculation indicates those who received it were probably the best nourished and dwelled in the most wholesome living quarters. In trying to evaluate the probable efficacy of smallpox inoculation in the 18th century, we must contend with this selection bias, that is, a distortion in a measure of association, such as a risk ratio, due to a sample selection that does not accurately reflect the target population. While Benjamin Franklin was haunted by the question of what if little Frankie had gotten inoculated, in the case of King George III and his wife Queen Charlotte, the anguish cut the other way when they lost two of their 15 children to smallpox inoculation gone wrong. Prince Alfred was inoculated a few months before his second birthday and fell deathly ill. Shortly after his death on August 20th, 1782, King George wrote to Prince William, "It has pleased the all-wise director of all things to put a period to the life of dear little Alfred, who certainly was as fine a child as ever was seen." Less than a year later, on May 3, 1783, Prince Octavius died at the age of 4 after receiving a smallpox inoculation. Still not recovered from their grief of losing Alfred, George and Charlotte were devastated. Judging by portraits of the little prince, he was an exceptionally beautiful and bright-eyed child. Later, as King George III slipped into madness, he suffered frequent hallucinations of the dead Alfred and Octavius. It seems likely that he and Charlotte often lay awake at night, wondering whether the little boys would still be with them, if only they hadn't received the smallpox inoculation. To be sure, the king and queen did not express such sentiments in their letters, but outwardly resolved to keep their faith in the procedure, with the calculation that it had probably protected their other children who'd received it. Looking back, one marvels at Queen Charlotte's avowed faith in inoculation, which had already been tested twice before the deaths of her youngest children. In 1768, her lady-in-waiting, Charlotte Louise Henrietta Albert, received the inoculation and described the procedure as two punctures in the arm near to each other, made with the point of a lancet, through which a thread, bearing the inoculum, was drawn several times under the skin, and this on both arms. Following this procedure, she experienced convulsion, fever, and inflamed pustules that rose and subsequently dried off regularly. Nevertheless, 7 years later, she was sickened with smallpox in full force. For 6 weeks, her entire body was covered with blisters. As she described it, "No one could give me any comfort or alleviate pain. I could only be lifted by four people, one at each corner of the sheet, to have my bed made, for not a pin's point could be placed between the pustules." To make matters even more confusing, Queen Charlotte's brother, Ernest, was inoculated 3 times in the 1760s without contracting any smallpox symptoms whatsoever, which puzzled Charlotte and her surgeon, William Bromfield, alike. This caused Ernest's inner circle to suppose he had had the smallpox, though he did not know it. Until this experience, Dr. Bromfield never seems to have considered the possibility that some people, perhaps even many people, had experienced subclinical smallpox infections that had rendered them immune before they underwent the inoculation procedure. Yet another factor that contributed to the difficulty of assessing the efficacy of variolation, and later a vaccination, is that smallpox has an estimated attack rate of around 60%. In other words, 40% of people who are exposed to the virus, even in close contact, do not develop the illness. While Queen Charlotte seems to have kept her faith in variolation, by the end of the 18th century, many in England had doubts about the safety and efficacy of the procedure and wondered whether there was a better way of protecting people from the dread illness. In this climate of hope for something new, an ambitious naturalist from Gloucestershire publicized an inoculation procedure using material collected from pustules on cow's udders, a veterinary disease commonly known as cowpox.